Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
I think everyone who's coming is here now. I know that Katie said before the break that she really didn't want local authorities coming, but is anyone here from a local authority? Yeah? I'm fine with it. I don't have a problem. It's okay. I don't know why she said that. It seems like I was talking to Jonathan outside, and you know, when I started by the bridge in 2000, my mother and I came up with a catchphrase that we borrowed from Mercedes that said, "Some things in life are too important not to share," and I think that that's true. We've all probably been to various different forums and things where you go in with the intention of having a nice roundtable discussion, open, talk about anything. And then the reality starts striking and you think, hold on a minute, I've got something here that gives me a competitive advantage. And I'm not going to reveal it in a room full of people who might steal it. I'm in the very fortunate position that I'm not actually pushing a product anymore. I'm not competing with anybody. Whilst I am involved, I'm a director of diverse care. I'm not involved day to day. It's not my main job anymore. So I feel as though I can more or less say whatever's on my mind, and I'm completely not shy about sharing anything at all in terms of what I've found to be helpful in this area of work. I've recently attended a couple of those forums that we go to, and it's still quite reserved, I'll say. Other than the ambush that I got when I first walked back to, what are you doing back in the industry? Which was, pleasant. But other than that, you know, people are still quite reserved about what they say in those things. So what I'm hoping from this afternoon session, and I'll keep it relatively brief, is my part of it, and then we're going to involve everybody. It's just simply, I want to look at what the title of the conference was, Recruiting Foster Parents and Tackling Delays, and say, what process do we take in terms of taking one of those initial applications on the phone? We can go backwards to the absolute starting point, the genesis of a fostering organization. So what do we do with that phone call? How do we then progress that through the system specifically, step by step? What do we do? And then how are we sure that we end up creating a foster parent who will have the best interests of the child at heart? Because I think looking at the attendees thing, quite a lot of people here are involved directly in recruitment. Is that fair to say? Yeah. Quite a number of you involved. And obviously, indirectly, anyone who works in the independent sector is inevitably thinking about recruitment on an ongoing basis. So all I'm going to do is start. And if people at the back can't read, if you want to come forward, please feel free, because there's going to be microphones and things for people watching online, apparently. So we receive the phone call. And can you just shout out, please? Well, what do you do with that phone call? Who handles it, typically? So if you've got some ideas within the organisation, who handles that initial expression of interest?
In our organisation, we have a separate... we outsource that.
Oh, really? Okay.
Have a list of selection criteria that they will go through all the questions and handle that initial screening call and then screen out that which does not meet the initial criteria.
So how much screening on that initial phone call generally? What do we get, typically speaking?
About 20 questions in our fundamental basics, i.e. do they have a spare bedroom, etc., that type of
yep.
thing. And there's a certain percentage of those questions that they have to be positive about before they get passed on to the recruitment team as such.
Yep, okay. Do you have any idea or any feeling of what number of people phone up and what number of people pass through that initial screening?
Approximately 20% gets through the initial screening.
80% fail?
Yeah.
On the initial phone call?
Yeah.
Wow. Is that general? I find that shocking. No, I'm asking the room. Really? 8 out of 10 people who phone up don't make it past the initial phone call? That's stunning.
When you say make it past, do you mean to like a face-to-face?
Yeah.
I think that sounds...
Various reasons.
Is it like sort of just
like
they don't have a spare bedroom, or
spare bedroom is one issue. Yes, they have to have a spare bedroom. The there are a lot of other factors, stability, driving towards stability of the home, of the family,
ages of their children, or there's many factors that gets them past. A lot of them just think, oh, well, it might be a good idea because they've been in the pub the night before and talking to somebody. And when they actually start going through the questionnaire, they realize that it's not something that they fit to do. So there's quite a lot of that kind of thing.
Do you think it'd be a good idea if we're talking about recruiting foster carers, is when we actually advertise this to outline specifics like having this?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So we don't ring up and
but that's successful, a lot higher than that.
I think I think that's right. I think being as specific as you can, and obviously people will whilst you can be as specific as you want to be in your initial advertising, however you project that, television, radio, newspaper, whatever, you can be very, very specific, and people don't always pay attention to all of it, so they'll call. And I think that we've all had in common myths. There's a lot of myths around fostering. It was talked about today. People have a very particular idea of what fostering is. And then when they start to make those initial phone calls, perhaps your screeners, and certainly if it's done in-house, somebody who's calling up will expect a little bit of education. You know, they want to know, how do you do it? What do you do? What type of children am I going to get? You know, you could spend an hour on the phone with every single initial applicant. That does happen from time to time. I'll tell you a little bit about what I used to do to avoid those really lengthy phone calls where you know that there's not a high percentage of success in terms of that initial phone call translating into a foster parent. So what are the next steps that we have for people after they've been screened on the phone call? Certainly, you know, for me, just to add a bit of the other end of the extreme, I would progress somewhere upwards of 80% of people who phoned to take them on to the next stage. So almost exactly the opposite of a couple of organizations' experience over here. So what's the next step for people after they've made that phone call? What do you do? What do you do, generally speaking? Because it's different depending on the organisation.
A lot of our applicants, inquirers, about say we can maybe come to an event, but not wedded to that. They have to.
Yep.
If it coincides with an information forum or a specific exhibition, then they might get invited to that and have a face-to-face with somebody.
Yep. That's one way. That's certainly the way I used to do it. Used to invite people to an information session so that we could go through and explain, spend a couple hours with people, you know, in a group, explaining exactly what it is that we do, why independent organizations are different from local authorities, why we exist, what we do, and so on. It gives you that opportunity to have that discussion with a group of sometimes upwards of 50 people, rather than having 50-hour-long phone calls. By design, when I was instructing people on how to handle that initial screening phone call, it was, unless there are some really obvious contraindicators, get them to an introduction night. That was my mission, you know, is to get talking to them, get engage them. Let's have a conversation. But other organisations I know, yeah.
Sorry, I'm probably going to ask a question about what would be the next step for other organisations.
Sure. Yeah.
What we do, Greater London Fostering, is from the initial phone call, we'd pay them an initial visit once they'd gone through that screening process. I'd anticipate also that we'd be looking at 8 out of 10 people going to the next stage.
Yeah, progressing from there to there. Yeah, that's. I think that's a fairly common part of the process. That people phone up, they pass the initial screen, somebody goes out to visit them in the home. And again, I as a business, when I was doing this, was looking at efficiency. You know, so I would say rather than have 50 visits from 50 families, 12 of whom are going to become foster parents, let's get them all in one group. Let's do it all at once. The initial visits can come later on in the process, but that's fine. I mean, people do it in different ways. You know, you send people out or you call them in. And part of my thing, and again, I'll just reiterate, I don't agree with Robert Tapsfield's approach. I don't agree that we should be shoving people through the system and encouraging them and dragging them through, because I think that what you're going to end up with is a family who really doesn't want to be a foster family necessarily. They might end up being the best family you've ever met. I think it's unlikely if you have to drag them through the process. So I do set hurdles, or did set hurdles, for people to jump over in order to become foster parents. Okay.
So 50 people to a group.
Yeah.
Out of those 50 people, how many will then go on to become to the next stage, to say the initial visit?
I'll break down my numbers for you at the end, or I can start doing it now if you like, but I don't think I'm particularly uncommon here. Let's say, for example, I received 200 phone calls. 170 of those would be invited to introduction nights. 105 might come, even with reminder phone calls and things to make sure they come to the thing. So, you know, you already cut that initial phone call number in half. You know, so, yeah, I mean, while you're saying, you know, you might progress with 2 out of 10, actually, ultimately, I'm probably only progressing with 5 out of 10, you know, the reality is. And then of that 100 families who would come to an introduction night, perhaps only half of them would fill out a full application form. You know, so already the numbers are dwindling quite drastically. You know, so we do it in different ways, you know, but we do end up with a massively reduced number at the end of the day. I'm not trying to say that I ended up with eight families for every 10 phone calls. Absolutely not.
We do it in 2 stages. We do an online inquiry. It takes about 15, 20 minutes. Online inquiry comes straight into the company, shows a commitment that you're prepared to sit there and actually engage with the process. We then send the application form, would be very specific around what we're looking for.
Yep.
And then we follow that up a week later because we feel that people need time.
Yeah.
With the opening, you know, come to the next forum, people have got the opportunity to then look around.
Yep. So the online application, which will go somewhere in here as well. Yeah, I think a lot of organisations now have taken a similar approach, might not follow it exactly prescriptively, but yeah.
They do have current carers ringing between the time of the application being sent and being received back. So we have a 5 or 7 day lead time where a current foster carer who can say as it is makes an approach to the applicant to ask if there's any questions.
That's great. I love that we've got actual foster parents telling people how it is. And that's something that you're right. Yeah, showing the foster parent that you're working with already that they're valued, they can have some value to add in the work, and then also you're showing a new family, this is what it's really like. You know, talk to someone who's doing it already. I think that's really good use of foster parents. Certainly I would have an experienced foster parent at group night, an introduction night, to have some real stories.
Yeah. Sorry, my comment was just going to be that out of the 20% that comes to me and I go and do the home visits, up to this point, every single one has gone into assessment. Mm-hmm. So there's nobody's been ruled out after the initial home visit because the initial screening process was detailed enough to get rid of the...
Yeah. So you're not going on home visits to one-bedroom flats and things?
No.
At some point, we do thorough screening. Everybody does, obviously.
Quite a large geographical area.
Sure.
So we don't...
You also need to be mindful of the IRM mechanism, in terms of the independent review mechanism, in terms of how we decline people that want to foster.
Yep.
In terms of not crushing them, but telling them they have a skill set, it could be not the right time.
Yep.
So I suppose it's being appropriate during the process... So it doesn't sort of make them feel that they can foster ever again. And it's actually being honest with them so that they actually accept that and actually move away without causing you conflict.
Yes.
Even in the current climate, they have a recourse.
Yeah. The part of the reason that I like the hurdle format, which is allowing candidates to pull themselves out of the process rather than me having... A very few families ever, I can remember, saying, you're not going to make it, discontinuing with the assessment. It's a very small minority, but the biggest number of families that are pulled out of the process pull themselves out. And that was documented really well, and I wish I could remember her name. I read the report recently. There's an American... she was a social worker, but she wrote... She was academic, really. She wrote extensively, and I'll put it up on a website, the link to her research, which is showing how you can design a self-withdrawing recruitment system, because I think it's really important, and particularly more important now with the costs involved with that, the appeal processes that can start happening, certainly. Okay, so through various methodologies, we've got phone calls, we've got online applications, we either are going to visit people in their homes initially, or we're inviting them to group, and then going on to initial visit. What next?
We have them introduce skills to foster.
Yep. Yeah. By and large, yeah. Nobody does it differently from that. Training.
Okay. So there's a natural selection of people withdrawing after skills to foster.
Yep, during. Yeah, it's an education process. Goes two ways. Absolutely. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. A well-designed skills to foster. I suspect that very, very few of us are using the original framework that we were given. It's been so adapted most times I've seen it, that it's almost unrecognisable, other than you've got a few, like the ball of string exercise and various others that seem to work nicely and people enjoy. You know, we've all personalised the structured training that people seem to accept as a basic format. Are people generally happy with the Skills to Foster framework in terms of what it delivers pre-assessment, by and large? Yeah.
It's been adapted so much, yeah. And the way our organisation work is quite disjointed in that it's rolled out differently depending on which region as well. So it'd be interesting.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'm.
There have been proposals recently where people are looking at a much more extensive training programme pre-approval. You're talking 4 weeks, unless you can pass out of various different phases of it, IT being one of the areas that I talked about in the presentation there as being absolutely critically important. I truly believe that you can't look after children, other people's children particularly, but children generally, unless you have a pretty good grasp of technology now. If you don't have access to computers at home, if you don't, you know, your children can't do their homework by and large. You know, I have teenage children as well as my two-year-old. They can't do their homework unless they've got internet access. You can't keep them safe unless you come up with strategies to monitor their Facebook and their Twitter accounts and all that sort of thing. So technology is becoming bigger. So they're saying, well, it's not okay now to be technology ignorant, if you're going to progress to be a foster parent. Well, then you might be a great foster parent lacking in those skills. Should we be delivering those pre-approval? Just a thought. I don't know where I stand on it particularly. I think it's quite tough to require people who you haven't employed yet to say, now you're on a four-week training course. But, of course, you know, if you're going to join a lot of other professions, the law, accountancy, whatever, people spend 3 years training. This is quite a difficult job, as we know. Perhaps we should require more than a weekend at a Holiday Inn in, Basingstoke or something. I'm not suggesting it's a great format. I'm just, I've heard people talking about it. So people do their Skills to Foster training. And then what?
Excuse me, sorry. Can I just add something?
Yeah.
Hello there, Roy Hipkiss, Director, Credo Care. One thing that we do when you're talking about putting hurdles in front of people, we make sure that people who are interested in fostering have a formal interview mm-hmm. with the fostering manager and the head of care, as if they're applying for a job, because we want to treat people like professionals, we want them to act like professionals. So therefore, by doing that, it's sort of an extra quality check before progressing further on. So therefore, after the initial visit, the person who does the visit would produce a report that is ready with the application form when the people have their interview.
All right.
And we actually find that is very helpful as well, because then people at that time, once they've had the opportunity to ask more questions and to interrogate the agency at a management level, they can either sort of self-select to go or think, yes, this is great, we can move on. And also it gives the senior management an idea of who's coming through. And so when they do go on to choosing to foster course, we've got a much better idea of the likely resource that will come out at the end.
Yeah.
So there is something that
Excellent.
Works quite well.
I like that a lot. I don't do that, or never have. Where does that come in? After the initial visit? Yep. Okay. So interview. And I love the message that it sends, which I don't know if everyone heard from them, but... Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Yeah, that you're treating people as professionals from day one. Lovely. Yeah, great message. And I was talking to people during the break about independent fostering started 25 years ago, more or less, in England. And then people were talking about professionalising foster parents. Still hasn't happened, I don't think. Not truly. But certainly the steps that we're taking, and that will be one of them, great, is an example of, actually... This is a job, it is a career, it is a profession, and we're going to treat you like one from the first step. I think that's great, I like that. Okay, training, what next? After they've done Skills to Foster, a few more people have dropped out, we've assessed some of their abilities. Form F, straight away? Yep. Okay. Stat checks simultaneously, before or afterwards? Where do people generally put them? Just... Yep. Okay. I try and do as many as I can in there, a step ahead, but obviously I remember when back in 2002, I think it was, when the CRB first really started kicking into gear straight after the Soho murders, and they were 9 months behind, I think, at that time. So, you know, they were promised by the government something like 5,000 a week. They were getting 40,000 a week. So, you know, understandably, they were behind. But, yeah, stat checks, obviously, you can hold us up. Like to put them in fairly early. Part of the reason I just want to sort of think about the rationale of why we do things in a particular order. And again, it's a shame there aren't more local authorities here, because I think they could probably learn from this to some extent. But, well, maybe they'll watch online later. But... it's cost. You know, if you look at where the cost elements are here, here's where we start spending money. You know, social workers don't come cheaply. Who here's a social worker, by the way?
Actually, I disagree.
Very few.
Yes, you start spending money
of course.
At the front end
already. No, of course we do. Yeah. No, I mean, money is spent at every single stage, but that's a big old lump.
Yes.
And you know, if we were to assess every single family who made that initial phone call, then we'll be out of business by the end of the year. So there has to be some filtering, obviously, before you get to that stage. But, you know, I know of organisations historically who you receive the phone call, they get an assigned social worker. Fundamentally, you're starting the F-form process from day one. Used to be. You know, I think that practice has, by and large, fallen away. But it probably still exists somewhere. And it's not a great business model, apart from anything, but it's also not appropriate. You know, to start digging into people's backgrounds and things when they're clearly not going to make it all the way through the process. Okay, so you've done your assessment, and then presumably everybody has, you know, a fully rigorous and thorough QA process prior to coming to panel.
Can I just ask you how people are managing that format assessment?
Sure.
Because we outsource all health and safety now.
Oh, good shout, yeah. So included in stat checks, I include health and safety, but actually...
Pet questionnaires, we get an oversight from the vet.
Yep, all right, okay. Well, that's quite nice, yeah.
Well, it's horses for courses, I think, talking about pets, but, you know, it is purely too many social workers are going out and saying that a potential foster carer's home is fit for purpose and they haven't got the skill set.
I think it's exactly, and I think there's a nice message there. I remember once being asked by a local authority, and I still won't name them, but different one from the one I was talking about earlier, who asked for a risk assessment on a goldfish. So and absolutely true. You know, West London Borough, I'll say that much. But risk assessment on a goldfish, doing pre-approval from vets reports and things like that. Yeah, it's nice. Health and safety certainly is an area that has developed. You know, historically, I know, you know, social workers used to wander around, and as long as there wasn't bared wires arcing in the wall, basically the house was fundamentally safe. I think that, you know, yeah, once we've actually finally got our heads around it and think, yeah, you're looking after somebody else's child, the taxpayer's paying a lot of money, we've got to make sure that child is safe. And we do it through safe caring, but actually the environment is absolutely critical. And people who aren't trained in that area shouldn't be doing health and safety. That's absolutely right. And I've had an experience recently where we at the new company, DiverseCare, they use a health and safety organisation that does all the gas safe and the PAT testing and all that kind of stuff that, you know, gives you a piece of insurance and a piece, you know, peace of mind that actually somebody who knows what they're looking for has gone through and said, yeah, electrics, gas, CO2, and all that kind of stuff. All, yep, fine, perfect, really happy with that. And then I had the assessor in the house saying that they wanted to lock windows upstairs because the child could jump out of a window. Well, this family, in connection with the health and safety company, had organised a means of escape plan. That was the window that was the one that led onto a low roof that then led out of the house. And actually, the social worker was putting the children at immediate risk of harm, from my perspective, because, you know, they'd completely ignored the health and safety and, you know, the work that the family had done in terms of what do you do with a fire, and said, no, lock that window. You know, well, no, not acceptable. So, no, good point. Well, you know, yeah, we have other issues around that as well, obviously absconding and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I think that that is being dealt with. And I think that, you know, the nod and the wink to that kind of practice, which historically has gone on, is no longer acceptable. You know, we can't lock windows to imprison children. You know, we know that that's not practical and it's not safe and so on. But what do you do to keep an absconding child safe? What do you do? You know, so there are, I know there are products out there that, you know, window alarms and all that sort of thing, that, yeah, are important, and we have to bear that in mind. Okay, go on.
So, I've only been working at St. Christopher's for a week, so I'm still getting my head around how all of this works. What's QA mean?
Quality assurance. No, it's just the Form F itself. How many people here have ever written a Form F? Yeah? Not many. Finding good assessors is tricky. It's a skill that I think is, when done well, phenomenally good. You know, when you find a really good assessor, you tend to hang on to them because they are difficult to find, good assessors. People assume that assessing a foster family is the easier end of the work. Yes, you're not dealing with violent people. You're not dealing with people with a history of mental illness. You're not dealing with drug abusers or, you know, the really difficult area of social work that you might go into. So you say to the social worker, no, I'll meet foster families. They seem quite pleasant. They've got a dog and a house. And, you know, everything's really quite nice. I'll write Form Fs. And then they don't realise actually to do the work well, you know, to interview a family properly, to get the information that you're looking for, and then present that in a way that is both accurate, thorough, presented on time, written in a way that the local authority actually get a feel for the family, that it's not just a black and white document with all the facts listed one after the other. Actually, it's a marketing document as much as it is a history of the family and a document of their beliefs and so on. So finding good assessors is very, very tricky, and it's not an easy task. You know, we struggle with, I think everybody struggles with finding good assessors and holding on to them that can produce reports that are meaningful and so on. Quality assurance is a really important step because quite often, until you've found those really good assessors, you have reports that you can't present to panel. Grammar, spelling, sounds silly. Happens, you know, lots of grammar, lots of spelling mistakes, not having all your questions answered, having a glaringly obvious section where, well, hold on a minute, they've had a recent death in the family, that hasn't been discussed at all. Well, it probably was discussed, they just haven't written it, you know. So QA is critical. Okay, if we think about how long that process takes, I know Robert found it almost inconceivable that that would take longer than 6 months. Generally speaking, what's the timeline from that initial phone call to approving a family as a foster parent? Six?
4 to 6.
Really?
Which
really?
Might be a minimum of 8 in terms of regulations.
I think 8 is more appropriate.
The regulations, yeah. Say that they need to reapply if it goes over 8 months.
Right, maximum of 8. Yeah. I think that it's great that people are now realising that there is a reason why you want to go through this process at a pace, not only because of regulations, but because it's a good idea. I think that quite often organisations historically, and not just local authorities, but independents as well that I've worked with, from there to there will take a year. I've seen it over and over and over again. I don't think it's uncommon. You know, things have moved on. I'm aware of that. But I'm still aware that that's happening with some companies, perhaps nobody in here, but it does happen. I'm glad that people are doing it. I mean, I'll draw you the chart that I've used a lot with families, which is that that's the initial phone call when the family rings up and they've probably thought about it for a couple of years and so on. And this axis describes excitement about the work. And this axis describes the time. And I think the longer that you take to take a family through the assessment process, the more their excitement wanes. And I have a suspicion, although I haven't proved it through quant research yet, that you're actually probably going to end up with a foster family who's not as successful as they could have been had you have processed them more effectively in the first place. And if you managed to bring them online there instead of there, you would have ended up with a family that could have looked after lots of children really well. If you take them through here, they might pull themselves out inappropriately. So having said that, I want to put these hurdles in the way to stop the weaker candidates from making it through. You want the strong ones to make it through, so work at pace, you know. So timeline. So we're saying it takes about 6 months to go from there to there. And if it goes longer than 8, then obviously we're in trouble with the regulators, but also we're ending up with a family that might not be working so well. I would say 6 months, for me, certainly historically, has been that's been going at a pretty good pace. You know, you have to run some of these things concurrently in terms of, you know, which processes you're going to short-circuit. When you're measuring that time, when, generally speaking, where do you guys start measuring? From the initial phone call or from the full application form? Okay, so you've bought yourselves a month or 6 weeks.
Yeah, because life happens, doesn't it, sometimes in between the phone call and them applying.
Well, absolutely.
It actually takes them 3 or 4 weeks to fill out, you know, the application.
And
legally, it's from the time of receiving the application.
Yeah. Well,
you have 8 months to assess.
Yes. But what I'm suggesting is that it's that phone call to panel is actually the time we should be measuring in terms of what we're doing, not just looking at the regs. The regs clearly are important, but let's think about that. Now, I wouldn't, again, want to force people. I don't force people. I don't encourage them. You know, if they take a full application or if they do it online or whatever, they don't get a phone call from me to remind them. You know, if they want to do it, they will fill out the application form and they will return it. But, yeah, there is quite a gap between... If you're doing it under the group method, like PACT, myself and various others, then there could be a gap there of 3 weeks, 4 weeks sometimes. Then you hand out the full application forms. There could be another 2 or 3 week gap in there. The interview kind of cuts into that quite nicely, I think, because then you've got something that you can proactively involve people in that means that you might encourage them. But from that phone call to the point where you receive the full application form could be 6-8 weeks, perhaps, you know, at times. So you're 2 months into what you're hoping is going to be 6 to 8 month process already. So I think that, as you said before, that's necessary. I think there is a necessary amount of time built in to allow people to think about it, to allow people to absorb the information that you're giving them either on the phone, through introduction nights or events or, you know, however you do it. I think that's very, very important to not rush people through that particular stage of the process. There are, again, coming back to the assessing bit, the training stuff, yeah, I mean, that's when you have your training on. People generally do it in a fairly coherent way. It's normally done over a couple of 3 days, maybe a weekend and a couple of weeknights and so on, but it's pretty tight, that bit, so there's not a lot of improvement that could be had there. Stat checks take as long as they take. I mean, that's, you know, we know that, dealing with local authorities, CRB and everything else. The Form F, I've often spoken, and this may be a little bit controversial, I've often thought the journalists would be the best Form F assessors that you could find. These guys are trained to interview people, they're trained to write, and they're trained to work to deadlines. You know, what a dream that would be if we had social workers who could do all of those three things really well. Clearly Ofsted would struggle with that concept. I haven't put it past them yet, I might do. We'll see. That time, you know, to get those visits in, to allow families a bit of time to absorb the information, because obviously the assessment isn't just an assessment of the family's qualities. It's also another opportunity for us to be able to educate the families and start instilling some corporate philosophy into them and, you know, re-educating people if they've got misunderstandings about the work that they've inherited, either through speaking to other foster parents or, from what they've picked up in the press and so on. So it's a good opportunity. But that process by design needs to take a bit of time. You can't bang out 6 visits one after the other, 6 days in a row, write a report over the weekend and then bring a family to panel, clearly. That's the ridiculous extreme the other way. So where's the balance? You know, where do we think it's right? Well, typically once you've handed a social worker the family, how long do you allow them before you expect at least a draft, or we'll say a fairly close to final report back?
3 months.
In our organisation, it's 14 to 16 weeks.
3 months, just more than 3 months, 3 to 4, yep.
But we've really tightened the timelines at the top end. So yep.
So that's two weeks there,
yeah,
roughly speaking.
Yeah, kicks off, and training happens
okay.
Concurrently with Form A kicking off.
Right, okay.
And stand checks and everything, they all run in the same timeline.
Yep. Because you have such a rigorous screening process that perhaps you don't feel the need to use Skills to Foster as the screening process that I use it for or that other people have used it for. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, however we do it, you know, we're saying to ourselves that, out of every 100 applicants, very roughly speaking, I would expect between 8 and 12 foster parents out of 100 initial phone calls. About normal? Too rigorous? Not rigorous enough?
No, but I'm just wondering out of the initial 100 phone calls, how many of them are choosing us? So we're talking about screening them. Mm-hmm. But they might have phoned us and you and the others. So there's a lot that are pulling out that we're not necessarily losing.
Sure.
So it's just interesting to understand what we're offering them at that stage that helps them choose us or choose another.
That's a really good point. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think the groups for us help that, but everyone has a different approach.
I think it's helpful. Yes, I believe
getting quick
the visits is where that key is, because ultimately, you know, as much as there's this social aspect, it is still a business, and people do business with people they like. And if they don't buy into you, they're not going to buy into your organisation. So it all comes down to what impact you as the initial, their first contact is. What is that initial perception from them? And if that is positive, they don't particularly... Case in point, I did a home visit with a couple who had four different agencies. Right. And I was the last of the four to see them. And she was upfront and honest with me and said, didn't like that person, because to them it was all about ticking boxes. That person came across as arrogant. And it was all down to the initial perception that you as a person made for them. And that I think, is a big deciding factor in who you go with in the end, not necessarily what you can provide. Because we all pretty much provide the same thing across the board.
More or less. Yep.
More or less, yeah.
Yep, yep. No, I think that's right. I mean, it was Eric Byrne who said the initial transaction dictates the relationship. So, you know, that's what we're saying now, is that initial phone call or that initial visit or that initial contact that you have with someone is absolutely vital. But I think really valid point, I'm sure we have all had families who've pulled out of the process and we want to go, oh, they're a great family. You know, they should have taken them. What happened there? And then at some point in time down the line, you realise actually they did become a foster parent. They're very successful. Thank you very much. They just didn't choose you. They chose somebody else. So I think we've probably all been through that. Quite often we might not get that follow-up bit to know what happened to the family. Sometimes we're lucky enough to indeed find that out. Okay. So I think by and large, I mean, I think that what we're generally doing in different ways, subtly different ways, clearly we're all following the same process by and large, but what we're subtly doing in different ways is working to a timeline that we know is important, we know why it's important, and we can't cut corners.
Can I just ask, if they're not attending the skills to bust it for 3 days, how is the process robust? What else is being done at that initial stage that you feel confident that you could cut out that training module? Right.
But it happens in conjunction with the actual, they may have one or two visits already in the process of performing with the social worker.
I think you missed, not do it, they just put it in here concurrently.
So we do an initial home visit, and based upon findings of that visit, we will make a recommendation to the service manager whether we think they should go forward to form it. They make that decision. Right. The decision is yes, that upon their process will start, they'll be allocated and they'll be invited onto the residential.
The skills to cost, then, so you sort of make it a bit more efficient.
Yeah.
I suppose it could be costly if they do skills and you feel that they're not
appropriate.
That's why I like to do the skills to foster before assigning them, because that's a group function. I'm going to run it anyway, so it doesn't cost me any more to have 9 families than 8. If that 9th family then pulls out during skills to foster, at least I've saved myself a couple of grand on not having them assessed as well, you know, or however much I've spent in the time before they pull themselves out of the process. So, that's why I do it that way. But again, you know, you do more rigorous screening early on. So, you know, I think, like I said, it depends. We all do fundamentally the same thing. I like your comment earlier on that, yeah, we do. So we clearly have to tick all these boxes along the way. And it's just how we do them, which order we do them, and, you know, what success we've had with that. So I suppose, you know, what I wanted to know from people, generally speaking, and I'm then going to wrap up, and if there are any questions, you know, please feel free. But... I've mentioned already on the training front that there is a move afoot, albeit quite a small move, because nobody here had heard about it, of increasing that training massively from 2.5-3 days up to 4-5 weeks potentially. So if we can think about that a little bit, but also the rest of the process, is what we're doing here appropriate? Does it produce good families? Is it the right way of doing it? Is there anything else that we could add or take away that would be required? That anyone? Yeah.
We also add a couple of online training courses.
Yeah, okay.
Through the assessment process to see the sort of basics around child protection, safety care, policy diversity.
Sorry, is that what you would class as your core training?
No, this would be online. It would be a snippet of what to expect when you are approved. But again, it shows if you can engage in online, it shows you're committed to the company in terms of doing more than just the assessment. And it also gives them a bit more of a skill set before they come to panel.
I think that's excellent, and I think that that's something that, that is going to become more and more common. You know, it's all very well for somebody to say to themselves, say to us, very technically proficient, I've heard of Twitter, you know, that's, yeah, no problem, I can do, you know, have a, an iPad at home, but actually have them prove it, pre-approval, is great. And certainly a few little elements of stuff that, you know, yeah, post-approval training, the first year sort of hard training program that we put together for our families once they start working with us is all critical stuff. And I often wonder to myself, really, should we be waiting 6 months to do, you know, pediatric health and safety, or, you know, that, that, you know, you know, that, the, you know, those programs that you think to yourself, you kind of hope our families would have that before they had a baby in the house, you know. Now, obviously, we don't have that luxury as parents. You know, we don't, you know, educate ourselves. And, you know, we do. I mean, we read books and we do what we have to do. But in terms of looking after other people's children, obviously, we need that belt and braces thing. And certainly starting to introduce that first year's post-approval training, pre-approval, I think is a great idea. It ticks loads of boxes for me. I love it. And certainly, you know, this conference today... and others like it are starting now to show us that actually, you know, this stuff works. You know, we're all, you know, I'm speaking now to just people in the room rather than the people on watching online. You know, we bothered to come today. We decided that we wanted to come to London for whatever reason and see in person what people had to say. I think having, particularly with foster parents, having the flexibility and the ability to show people stuff online, you know, I forget what people are starting to call secondary carers now. I still call them primary and secondary carers. So the person who stay at home full-time, typically the mother, then the father, I would call a secondary carer. There's a new term for it? No? Anyone? No, all right, well, I have heard bandied around that, that they don't like primary and secondary. They're both co-carers, and it's just the one who goes out to work and the one who doesn't, but I forget what term they use. Anyway, to have, you know, access to online training, you know, even after approval, I think is critical. I don't think I could push technology enough to say how important it is for all of our families to allow them the flexibility to be able to do the school runs that were described with that chap with six children of his own and three foster children. And, you know, I'm wondering when his wife does get to go to training and stay up to date and, you know, go to her supervisions and all that sort of thing. I mean, that's just stunning, you know, the work that they're carrying out. But making it as easy as it possibly could be, but then also satisfying yourself. So, you know, computers are great at that. You know, you know, people do have access to it. They can prove they've watched. You can set tests online to say, yeah, they're competent, they've understood, and they've fed back to us, you know, what they've done. But, yeah, certainly introducing that pre-approval, I think, fabulous, great one. And I mean, I think probably historically that's just a step beyond what some assessing social workers used to do when, you know, here's a book, a boy called it, yeah, read that, you know, that might help. You know, that sort of thing that the assessors used to do back in the day. I think now we can be a little bit more sophisticated than that, than read a couple of books and, you know, let us know that you've read them. I think we can, and that seems to be a really sensible way of doing it. Is there anything else that people think that they'd like to add pre-approval to families, whilst bearing in mind that we don't want to extend the deadline too much? In group.
Yeah. So, yeah, so it's because we use independent social workers for our form F, so it's just to engage them with our own staff to make sure they're coming to the office to see us and finding out how they're getting on.
I think that's, again, another really important point for us as independents to think about, which is that you know, what we're working with here is a self-employed group of disparate people, all with varying different interests and beliefs and all, you know, all the things that we know we deal with. Is how do you whilst not wanting to treat them as indentured servants, which I think some organisations tend to do, we want them to feel part of the organisation, and I think that's a great way of starting to get people connected even before they're approved. And obviously they'll be meeting other of your families, I imagine, on the training that you'll be using, experienced families. A lot of people do that now, you know, to speak from first-hand experience, that you know, with credibility and so on. So I think really important, yeah, branding them, as it were, with your corporate identity, even pre-approval. Yeah, great.
We also
do a report
review during the assessment.
So, month and a half in, yep. Get the assessors in, group, individually?
No, manager goes out and joins the social worker with the family to review to date, what's to come, make sure everything's...
How many visits? What have they covered? Yeah.
Whether it's on track, stumbling blocks, any issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I think quite often, again, historically, some of this practice sounds historic, but I think we constantly have to remind ourselves that, you know, there are some slippery slopes that we can go back to, you know, fairly easily, you know, if we're not vigilant. One of the pitfalls that I used to come across quite often, and we're talking a dozen years ago now, and I really don't see it very much anymore, is that you'd get to the end of the assessment process, and then you'd have an assessor come to you and say, this family needs quite a lot more work. They need some diversity training, and they need some this and that and everything else, you know. I'll be happy to provide it, the assessor, because I've also got a training company over here. You know, so I think we've all seen that, and I think that because we're aware of that, you know, cynical practice, that you know, it probably is less common than it used to be. But you know, easy to fall back into it if we're not aware that of some of the shenanigans that can happen. Great. Okay. Well, it sounds like we're pretty robust. You know, again, I know firsthand recent experience in the last year with two or three local authorities and two independents that they are taking a year. Taking a year from the phone call to approval, which is the timeline that I measure that I think is important. So I think that, you know, perhaps, you know, we here have a room full of people who are, you're the people who bothered to come to conferences, you're the people who are bothering to educate yourselves and I think really helpfully talk in a group about stuff that historically people would never have talked about. How do we do it? How is it different that we do it, that we're successful and somebody else isn't quite so successful? So I'm really glad that you guys have spoken up and told us some things that are helpful. And I think that's progress. And I can only hope that, you know, that progress continues, because I think that it is a signal that 25-year legacy of, you know, professional foster parents is finally starting to come through. And I'm really, really pleased about that. Sorry, you had a question?
I was going to say that I'm a local authority now. It was a year. It's now 6 months.
Right, so you've managed to reduce it down, yeah. In what sort of time frame? When was it a year? When was... Okay, so you've managed in the last year to change your practice and measure it and say, we've reduced that time from a year down to 6 months. I mean, obviously, we kind of know what the outcome is, that you now just do all this in 6 months. What was the roadblock historically?
Questionnaire and left it for them to return it if they wanted to or they didn't, and often they didn't really know what to do, they didn't know what they were expected to do.
Yeah.
But now we do, we're clearer and we follow up as well. Mm-hmm. So we bring them and find out, you know, kind of what do you want to do.
Yeah.
We get things like the application form out early, we put them into preparation group quite early so they have a date before they come off.
Okay.
The
Yeah. And historically that wasn't. It was more ad hoc and as and when. And
yeah, it's just a bit more
laid back,
really.
I suppose the outcome is, the reality is, yeah, not interested. And I think it's interesting that you said that. But I suppose that's real. I mean, yeah, otherwise it would have been done in 6 months. If you were motivated and keen, you know, which makes that frustration of, you know, after the fact we have to use in-house, you know, the local authorities quite often have before they'll even consider looking at independence, all the more frustrating. Because, you know, if you're not that bothered, play some more with independence, you know. But, you know, point well taken. That was, yeah.
Probably our copy now, and, you know, practices change.
It's probably a bit early to tell whether you're producing a better family at the end of the day. You don't know yet. It's, you know.
We've got some brilliant families. Right. We have.
And do you think that speeding it up has had an effect? Has had a positive effect? You know, within the within your local authority.
Yeah.
So people feel better about the process. The families are feeling more energised.
Definitely. Correct. I mean, because they tell friends, they tell other people.
Yeah.
Somebody knows somebody who's thought it was okay when I went there, so then they
come. Yeah, I think historically, you know, the independent sector has actually benefited from having a family that's 9 months into an assessment process with a local authority and saying, I don't know, I haven't seen my social worker for 3 months, you know, can you go, you know, how quick can you get me through, you know, and so on. So we have benefited from that in the past, but now you're getting your act together, it's going to be that much tougher for us. So.
Well done.
Yeah.
Great.
Can I just add a development need in terms of this process, which we've seen and I've pushed with various statutory bodies but hasn't been achieved, is a national register for foster carers.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
There's GPs, there's social workers, we have so many that...
HCPC. Technology's finally caught up with us.
It's definitely manageable and definitely needs to happen.
Carers, and we're going through a process, but there is no outlet. We can't inform anybody.
Yeah.
If the practice is not appropriate, then we deregister and...
For those of you who didn't hear, national registration for foster parents. Couldn't agree more.
Just for clarification, does that concept of national registration mean that I'm working for you, I'm a foster care, but I work for you, I'm registered, but I'm registered nationally, so if I want to leave your organisation and go to a different organisation, I don't have to deregister and re-register?
I haven't thought it through. The issue we've had at the recently is we've had a couple of families that have applied to foster, and we've found out in a roundabout way that they've actually applied and gone through the process to handle with another agency, and we were unable to ask those questions. We've asked the right questions, we were very robust, and they decided to tell us untruths.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a national register, we could check whether they've applied,
recruited,
would be registered, desired.
So as soon as we got a full application, we would register the family on the date of this. Hold on a minute, you're already on it. what's going on? Yeah,
but also, there is a register in terms of some foster carers that have been deregistered due to their practice.
Certainly,
that's about keeping children safe.
Without question. And
knowing what resources we have nationwide, certainly I used to do a speech that involved knowing what we have nationally in terms of resources, and we'd have I'd show where every single cow in the country sounds a bit silly, but actually the Minister for Agriculture knows where every single cow in the UK is because they've got ear tags and they're registered within parish boundaries. The Minister for Education doesn't know where his foster parents are, by and large.
Vacancies, it would help with hotspots of vacancies.
Exactly. Recruitment, fine-tuning it, matching, and everything else that goes along with that. Absolutely. Okay, I think I'm being wrapped up here, so thanks very much, everybody. That was a really good session. Enjoyed that. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.